From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. A statewide protest group wants North Carolina to reopen as quickly as possible from the COVID-19 economic shutdown. You'll learn why one congressman decided to highlight that group's constitutional rights. The John Locke Foundation's CEO turns her attention to neighbors reporting on neighbors when it comes to violations of government shutdown orders. The head of a Western North Carolina Emergency Management Department discusses challenges for emergency workers across the state. And we'll turn attention to the COVID-19 pandemic's potential impact on 2020 elections. Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
With North Carolina remaining under a statewide shutdown order at least until May 8th, the focus for Governor Roy Cooper and his administration has now turned to testing and tracing and trends. Now, these are the items that are key to the metrics the governor says he's going to be using to decide when he will lift government restrictions on work and movement. But our next guest says that's not quite all the information we need. He says the Cooper administration should be running more models, and very specific models. Don Vandervaart is senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. He is also the former secretary of the Department of Environmental Quality for the state of North Carolina. Don, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You were writing a lot about this. You started your analysis really with the fact that several North Carolina state senators have been urging the Cooper administration to do more modeling. So exactly what do you believe we should be modeling? What should we know that we don't yet know?
Well, first, we have to talk about modeling generally. Modeling can be very simple. It can be very complex. We know something about modeling in our lives when a hurricane is forecast, and we look at these the update of the hurricane, and there's hurricane tracking charts.
We're used to seeing the big cone of possibility.
There's a cone of uncertainty, right, of what that actually is, and sometimes you see these spaghetti curves, and that's really individual model runs being run under different conditions. The thing about modeling is when you're trying to model something very complicated, you can imagine our knowledge isn't absolute, and so the output is somewhat uncertain. So what do modelers do? Modelers tend to look back in time and take historical data and fit their models to that historical data by tweaking some parameters. And the hope is that if it fits the past, it'll give you a better idea of the future. Another thing they do is they'll take multiple models and run them all with the similar scenarios and see how they compare, because each model has some different assumptions built into it. And what first of all, what the senators asked was, hey, you all did some modeling early on and using a model by the University of Washington. After a while, the DHHS stopped using that model. Coincident, by the way, with the time that that same model predicted a very, very, very large decrease in COVID occurrences here in North Carolina. But then DHHS used another model, a kind of a modified University of Pennsylvania model, and they only ran it under two conditions. One, where there were no restrictions at all. Everybody just shook hands and didn't wash their hands, didn't stay at home.
The other, and that, was, of course, has not occurred.
Which seldom occurs, I think. The other being total restrictions. And those two are sort of extreme scenarios. And what the senator said is, hey, why don't you run some more realistic scenarios in between? For example, a Swedish-type model, which Florida followed with such success, which is, let's just focus on the older component of our demographics, and those with pre-existing conditions, and make sure that they are quarantined, et cetera. And the rest of the population just goes as they please. That's a different scenario than those other two. The other is, how about taking account just everybody washing their hands like they ordinarily would during flu season and whatever other precautions they take? So that's a fourth scenario. Now, that makes a lot of sense. My interest would be to do that, to also, though, use other models. For example, run the models that the University of Washington model, which has been used by a lot of other states. And I would also ask that you should just go granular and run those models at the county-by-county level.
That's an interesting point, Don, about county-by-county, because the statewide shutdown order is, in fact, that. It affects the entire state in exactly the same way. We've already heard from and seen some local government officials say, you know what, I know what's going on the ground in my community, and what happens maybe in one community in the western part of the state is not occurring in the eastern part of the state.
It makes no sense at all. Mecklenburg County, Wake County, they may have their own set of challenges, but many of the other counties, some counties don't even have an occurrence yet at all of COVID, and others have very, very few. So these need to be handled differently. And we have the machinery in place. We have county health departments that know their own counties better than anyone. Well, I would just suggest using some models to help those folks understand where they are.
If we have the capabilities to do this kind of additional modeling that would be more granular, as you put it, it seems like that would really help to inform the decision making as to where we should go, not just as a state, but as local communities in that state. Why is this not happening?
I don't understand. From a simplistic level, it might be simpler to have everybody do the same thing all the time. But from a standpoint of trying to weigh the costs to the economy of these kinds of restrictions versus the benefits. The benefits aren't going to be seen in these counties that don't have the major challenges that, for example, maybe New York City, certainly, and to a much lesser extent, Mecklenburg and Wake County. You're exactly right.
Now, as you and I are talking, we have upwards of 800,000 North Carolinians who have applied for unemployment insurance benefits just in the last few weeks because of this, in part because of the statewide shutdown order that is in place at least until May 8th. I can tell you, Don, that, you know, I'm a middle-aged woman. I have not seen anything like this in my lifetime. I'm the child of Depression era parents. I know that just hearing them talk about it, they didn't like to talk about it a lot. They would basically joke about it in terms of not having enough to eat, going to work. My father, when he worked in the fields when he was, you know, 8, 9 years old, he had to try to help support the family. It changed my parents as people. Is that what we're living through now for this generation?
I think it's certainly a lot closer. The idea is we're going to be able to get through this. I'm worried that unlike a human body that recovers from a disease, I'm not as positive that the economy will recover as quickly as the human body. There are going to be some small businesses that are not coming back. And this is going to create a recession, and it's going to create a severe recession. We don't know how long. But it seems to me that this is an example, I think, as you pointed out, for this generation of a really tough challenge, an existential threat, you might say, that's being posed by this coronavirus, not just by the virus itself, but the economic remnants of our economy after this passes.
I think there's going to be a lot of unintended consequences that we won't know for years as to how people approach life, whether it is their ability to earn a living, whether it is their physical health and well-being, even their view of government and what the role should and should not be. Maybe more of a focus on constitutional freedoms, which, of course, here, the John Locke Foundation, we hope that's the case. We write about that a lot. You also write about this issue of modeling that we've been talking about. Folks can read that at johnlocke.org. org. Don Vandervaart, Senior Fellow with the John Locke Foundation. Thank you, Don.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly. But our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. As North Carolina wrestles with the best way to reopen the state for business amid the COVID-19 pandemic, tens of thousands of people have signed up with a social media group dubbed Reopen NC. Many of them converged in Raleigh on April 14th. They protested government orders that keep them from working and operating small businesses. Police broke up that protest and arrested one woman. A week later, our next guest decided to join a follow-up protest. U.S. Representative Dan Bishop is North Carolina's congressman representing the 9th District. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Mitch. Good to see you. Good to be with you.
You too as well. And there are plenty of things you could be doing as a member of Congress, lots of weighty things that that our nation's legislative branch is dealing with. Why come to Raleigh to participate in this protest?
I can't think of anything more weighty than carrying out the duty that I was sworn to, and that's to defend and protect the Constitution of the United States. When last week, as you mentioned in the lead, folks, the Raleigh police, after in the course of that protest, issued that unfortunate tweet that went viral that said, "Protest is not an essential activity." I knew from that moment that I was going to be at the next Reopen NC event because the right to protest, the right to peaceably assemble and to petition the government is secured to people by the First Amendment of the Constitution. And the Constitution doesn't get suspended under a stay-at-home order. It still exists, and it still secures important rights, and they have to be kept in balance. And so – and there's some other rights that it guarantees as well. But I knew that I was going to be here to honor and support the great work being done by the people who formed that organization or that group, social media group, and those like it across the country.
What did you think when you first saw that tweet from the Raleigh police that got so much attention?
I had some sympathy, frankly, for whatever poor person, poor tweeter on behalf of the department put that up. There is a lesson in that, which is we tend to forget about fundamental things sometimes when we get bogged down in the details of everyday governance. And I think that Roy Cooper has made the same error that police, whoever was at the police department, put that dumb tweet out. And what I mean by that is the governor, even as a fair amount of time has gone by under his stay home order, he's allowed that to remain now pending indefinitely. He's not articulated when it will end. Moreover, he has not set forth any plan with definitive criteria for when it would cease to exist. He's talked about this little alliterative gimmick slogan, testing, tracing, and trends, but it's not really clear what he means. And more to the point, one of the other rights secured by that First Amendment is the right of a free media, the right of the press, free press. And that implies that government will be transparent and will disclose, especially when in the middle of an emergency in which confidence would be promoted by disclosing information. And the disclosure by the governor and his administration has been sorely lacking. Same for county officials. We don't know what models the governor's depending on, and to the extent he's depending on a volunteer group of epidemiologists, he has not had them put all of their information out in public so that it can be vetted. That's exactly what they should be doing.
We are chatting with U.S. Representative Dan Bishop, who represents North Carolina's 9th District, also remembers Roy Cooper from your days working in the state Senate. And one of the things that has cropped up here is that when people have talked about reopening North Carolina, one of the responses from the other side is, but hey, this is a health emergency. I mean, if people are going back to work, we're going to see this pandemic wreak all kinds of havoc and potentially major loss of life. Why do we not have to just defer to the health experts on this?
It's fundamentally contrary to our system of governance and our view of the dignity of each individual to expect anyone to stand and have their privileges and rights suspended without explanation. We just don't do it that way. And now let me say something that I want to be very clear about. The COVID-19 pandemic is a very serious threat. And we need to maintain social distancing behaviors, and they need to go on even though the lockdown needs to end. What we see in all of the data that is available, if you examine it carefully, is that the numbers, the anticipated, the projected volumes of bed needs and ICU needs and so forth, they've all fallen below expectations repeatedly. The models have had to be revised downward. There's an indication there that the lockdowns have overshot their mark. And perhaps one reason that those things have not even been predicted, even though the models incorporate distancing, is because it may well be because that they didn't take into account the effects of voluntary distancing before the lockdown orders took effect. But in any event, we seem to have exceeded the mark that we need to. And so now these vague justifications, shifting rationales the governor's offering to just say he's going to lift this sometime in the future, but he doesn't know when, they won't do. That's all there is to it.
We mentioned that the April 14th event is what prompted you to come to Raleigh. So you participated in the April 21st event. What'd you think going down there and hanging out with those folks?
It renewed my pride as an American. That really is. I was talking with folks I was with as we were departing. There's an exhilaration that comes from seeing people stand up for liberty. Liberty, Ronald Reagan said, it doesn't get passed on in the bloodstream. It has to be fought for and protected. And every generation and every few years, there's always a threat to freedom. I saw a tweet, somebody responding or criticizing me as I drove over here, that, people forget about how important this is and that it never goes away, even in an emergency. Your rights aren't subsumed by the state in this country. That's what this country's very essence is.
As a member of Congress or as a North Carolinian in general, what do you hope happens next in this state?
I think we need transparency and we need a plan. So transparent, both of those are very fulsome words and they each mean a lot. The governor needs to turn a new page with respect to the way his Department of Health and Human Services is operating. It's not sufficient to say, well, trust us, we have experts, they'll make your decisions for you. They've got to put out data. They got to put out models. Their models have to make sense. They have to track actual outcomes, or they have to admit that they're wrong. We need a plan under which we continue to maintain very rigorous social distancing activities, under which the governor sets goals and moves in the direction of reopening the state. And he really ought to retract something that I think has been followed in state after state and is fundamentally ill-conceived, this notion of categorizing people and businesses as essential and non-essential. Nobody in our society is non-essential.
U.S. Representative Dan Bishop is North Carolina's congressman representing the 9th District. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The COVID-19 pandemic has prompted John Locke Foundation CEO Amy O. Cook, the Right AOC, to launch a new commentary. It's called The Right AOC on Point. It's been focusing on issues critical to recovery from the pandemic. In a recent edition, she focused on the pandemic's impact on neighbors.
Would you tell on your neighbor for not practicing safe social distancing? Just a few weeks ago, no one had ever heard of the term social distancing. Now, it dominates our lives, and people are calling the authorities on their friends and neighbors who they don't think are complying with all the rules. A sister think tank in another state got a knock on the door from local city officials who said a complaint was called in against them, claiming they weren't adhering to safe social distancing guidelines, and even questioning whether they were essential workers. Quick side note, I go to a really dark place when government is determining who is and who isn't an essential worker. Now back to telling on your neighbor. Reason magazine put it best. As an epidemic, snitching seems to be competing with the virus itself in its spread. In the first few weeks of the shutdown here in North Carolina, Charlotte had over 1,400 complaints called into the police department. Wake County had nearly 500, with the most at 164 complaints coming from Cary. Now, we all acknowledge that COVID-19 is very serious. It's a very serious medical and health issue. People are contracting the disease, and some are getting very sick. And unfortunately, some don't survive. But as we concern ourselves with the spread of COVID-19, it's also appropriate to worry about collateral damage. Part of that collateral damage is what we are doing to our free society. In a society that rewards petty tyrants, trust breaks down. So do community bonds. Then people aren't just isolated physically, they're isolated emotionally. That's dangerous and can be long-lasting. For positive ideas on how we can recover and how we can address COVID-19, visit johnlock.org. And for all the latest COVID-19 news, check out the award-winning Carolina Journal at carolinajournal.com. Please also check out our donate button in the upper right-hand corner. Every dime you invest now is an investment in our future for freedom. Now, if you have questions, feedback, or you've been told on, email me at therightaoc@johnlock.org. Stay safe and stay healthy.
That's Amy O. Cook, the Right AOC. She's the John Locke Foundation's CEO. As she mentioned, you can respond to her commentary by writing to therightaoc@johnlock.org. You can follow her on Facebook and Twitter at the Right AOC. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Local emergency workers are among those affected most directly by the COVID-19 pandemic. State lawmakers heard recently from Will Keller, Emergency Services Director for McDowell County and Vice Chairman of the State Association of EMS Administrators.
Never have we faced a threat that not only poses a significant threat to us coming to work, but also when we leave work, going home to our families and potentially infecting those that we live with.
Keller discussed how emergency departments are coping with COVID-19. He discussed the value of a relatively new innovation, community paramedics.
We are really utilizing community paramedics in this pandemic to respond and meet the individual community needs of our citizens. Specifically, we're utilizing community paramedics to do welfare checks on senior citizens, many of whom have not left their homes in weeks, are in need of meals, or have special medical needs that can be addressed by the community paramedic. But we're also using them as part of our surge capacity and planning to link in and provide telehealth within our community. That's a big deal for us as a rural community. We have went live with our telehealth program that links community paramedics and our EMS ambulances to a local hospital. And that is part of our plan to try to keep as many people as possible out of the emergency department if they do not have acute signs and symptoms that need immediate attention. That improves the safety of the patient, improves the safety for those in the community as we're able to keep more people at home and decrease the spread of this virus, and also in, increases the amount of resources that are available to meet the most urgent needs.
Among the top concerns for emergency workers, access to personal protective equipment, also called PPE.
We are sourcing here in our local community from the private sector as much as possible, as we know the state and the federal supply has dwindled. And that's something that really concerns us on a daily basis, is ensuring that our employees and healthcare professionals and those on the front lines in our community and really in the state have access to personal protection equipment as we move through this pandemic.
Keller says emergency workers are also taking steps to ensure they don't spread the disease.
Making sure that our employees, if they become sick, that they do not expose additional family members. And through cooperation with local foundations and other agencies, we've come up with a plan to be able to shelter those employees at an off-site facility if they were to test positive for COVID-19, to prevent them from taking it home to their children and other family members. So collective partnership, and I think that is the key that we're seeing in our organization, in our community, is people coming together, partnering, people who normally may not work with each other on a daily basis, if their line of work doesn't intersect. You're seeing those lines of intersection play out very clearly during this pandemic.
Child care has been an issue for those spending time working in emergency services.
Our own community, we have a nonprofit that has stepped up, and I know the state has continued to work on this as well, to provide child care or assist in providing child care for frontline first responders and healthcare professionals. And that has allowed our workforce, one of the reasons our workforce has remained strong here in our community.
That's Will Keller, Emergency Services Director for McDowell County. He also highlighted the importance of relaxing a state regulation.
Also want to take a moment to thank the Office of EMS for their work in quickly waiving some administrative rules and other type of regulations that pertain to staffing of EMS ambulances. The normal requirement or everyday requirement is two credential providers on the ambulance. There is a way for agencies to apply for a waiver, which allows us to go down to one credentialed provider who would provide the patient care in the back of the ambulance in the patient box, but also but allow a approved driver to drive the ambulance. Now, the reason this is important is if we start seeing significant staffing shortages due to infection rates among our staff, we're going to look for non-traditional personnel such as transit, potentially school bus drivers, or those who are adequately trained to operate a large vehicle to serve as a driver for our EMS ambulances and have that paramedic, one paramedic in the back to provide that life-saving care. So that waiver is in place. Agencies can apply. They have really went out of their way to make sure EMS agencies are supported and that we have the tools necessary to take care of the citizens in North Carolina.
How can a local emergency team get relief from the state rules?
If an agency gets into a staffing crisis, there's a very short form that we send in to our local regional office of EMS in which it will be approved per the guidelines that were sent out. So there is a procedure in place. The only thing needed now is the agency has to fill out the application and send it in.
Keller says turnaround for those requests is quick.
I would anticipate less than 24 hours. Just with working with our local regional office, they've been very responsive to any needs that we have.
Keller noted the important role of people outside state and local government.
We have the faith-based community in our county that has stepped up beyond measures and has partnered with other nonprofits, with businesses, to where they have a substantial feeding operation ongoing. They've set up a assistance through call center online. People can go to request assistance in trying to look for a job or if they need feeding. food, groceries, other types of things that we're seeing. And it's called McDowellCares.com. And what that has done, and I wanted to highlight it because it's such an important relationship for emergency services, emergency management, to have volunteer organizations embedded within our emergency operations center, to where we have close coordination and the ability to reach out beyond our agency to others to assist our citizens who are having unmet needs during this disaster, as each family is dealing with this in a different way and has different needs. So it certainly benefited the Emergency Operations Center in numerous ways, and certainly want to thank the volunteers across many organizations for stepping up, not only in our community, but across North Carolina as we all work together as one team.
Lawmakers asked Keller, what kinds of equipment do emergency workers need?
Masks, surgical masks, face shields, gloves, hand sanitizer. Those are some of the main types of personal protection equipment that agencies are commonly requesting. We're also doing our due diligence at a local level to do our part in trying to partner with area industries who have really switched over. We have one industry here that has begun manufacturing face shields. We're exploring every avenue and not leaving any rock unturned.
That's Will Keller with McDowell County Emergency Services and the State Association of EMS Administrators. He shared emergency workers' COVID-19 concerns during a recent presentation for state lawmakers. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. With COVID-19 dominating the news and our lives, it's kind of easy to forget that we actually have a big-time election coming up just about 6 months from now. President, Governor, U.S. Senate, U.S. House, Council of State, and all members of the North Carolina General Assembly. So what about the campaigns? How do you campaign during a crisis? Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. He's been following some of these races and joins us now. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
Anybody campaigning during this, or are they just really blotted out of the news cycle?
Well, they can't campaign in a traditional manner because they can't go to picnics, they can't go to events and forums and things like that.
Or shake hands,
or kiss babies.
Right.
They can't do any of that stuff. But they are doing a lot of online communication. In fact, a day does not go by that I don't get at least 3 or 4 solicitations from someone because I got on their mailing list to see what their campaign was up to. And apparently their campaign is up to shaking people down. That's what they're doing online right now. But it really has changed things. And we had a recent story in CarolinaJournal.com, which talked about how things change. Some candidates are choosing not to do a lot of fundraising right now because they don't really think it's appropriate with the economy in such a free fall to try to ask people for money. Others are completely shameless about it and they're asking all the time. So it just, a part of it depends on
now more than ever. I need you.
That's right. How that perspective plays out. This is a sort of campaign that's going to be difficult, I think, for challengers to break through. Incumbents have huge advantages because anytime they wish to gain an audience, they can simply say, I'm going to talk about something, and media outlets will flock to follow them. And so it's a difficult time for people who are on the outside to try to break through. There's hope, of course, that you're going to see something approaching a more traditional campaign by Labor Day. But again, that still remains to be seen.
Well, speaking of riding high and getting a lot of media attention, Governor Roy Cooper, he has been presiding over the state updates on the statewide shutdown order and also the pandemic and how it's going. Several different polls showing him doing really, really well amongst Democrats, his own party, but Republicans and independents as well. He is well over 50%. Is this race for governor, which he's running against Dan Forrest on the Republican side, is the race really Roy Cooper's to lose now?
It's going to be very difficult for Dan Forrest to break through unless something unfortunately catastrophic happens. And that's the situation that you often find yourself in if you're a challenger going against a governor who's dealing with a crisis and whose management is getting fairly high marks. Now, Lieutenant Governor Forrest's constituency are largely comprised of the sorts of people who would tend to oppose a lot of the shutdown orders and the like, or would tend to say that they go too far, they need to be relaxed. But it turns out that so far, people tend to be favoring at least the concept of continuing to do a very gradual reopening. Part of that has to do with the fact that Washington has decided to have our grandchildren provide all the money to keep people afloat as much as possible. But you never can tell what would happen. Let's say if at Labor Day, if North Carolina, for instance, is several weeks behind its neighboring states in reopening the economy, the neighboring states are doing pretty well. North Carolina is still stuck in neutral. That could be an issue that Lieutenant Governor Forrest runs on. But one of the problems he has is people in his own party aren't necessarily helping him out, and that Senator Tom Tillis, who's running for reelection, is basically backing Governor Cooper. And so it makes it even a bigger challenge. Besides that was Dan Forrest's big strength, was grassroots support, going to every county in his bus and meeting lots of people. Right. And he can't do that right now.
Rick, to your point about things happening around the state, the members of the General Assembly, right now, everybody is really trying to be bipartisan in terms of supporting the governor because we're all in this together. It's a public health issue and all that. But you're starting to see cracks and disagreements, not only amongst members of the General Assembly, but local officials.
Right.
But when it comes to running those races for all 170 seats in the General Assembly, do you think that the pandemic is going to become an issue in terms of, well, maybe some sections, counties, regions of the state weren't as hardly hit, and therefore they feel like they were unduly bearing the economic burden of the shutdown. You anticipate any of that going on?
There may be some of that happens. There will be some areas of the state that are going to say, we weren't singled out. Everybody was treated with a one-size-fits-all shutdown. And guess what? We were doing okay. We had the opportunity to reopen our economy and start doing better, and we were denied that. And so that could well be a theme of the campaign in the fall. I also should mention, though, that the General Assembly is in session as we're taping this segment. They are likely to come back again mid to late May. They may come back again in the summer. And so they are not allowed to do a lot of fundraising while they're in session. And if it turns out that they are in a lengthy session, and I would guess that the session, any session that they do starting in July, when they really have an idea of how much money that they have coming in, those may be long sessions. And so it's quite possible that the traditional campaign may not kick off until very, very late in the season. And so the normal time when people would be doing fundraisers and doing events and things like that, that's going to be pretty much closed off to them.
It's kind of interesting about the fiscal issues that we're facing, because on the one hand, it seems like Republicans in general running for the General Assembly would be able to make the argument, hey, we have been good fiscal stewards, and therefore we have a rainy day fund, and now it's proven that we were right to put away money because now we can help people. On the other hand, Democrats, who in general want a bigger, more robust government presence, would be able to say, look, time of crisis, it's government that came through for you.
Well, Democrats are making that argument because they're continuing to argue for Medicaid expansion. And this is one of the arguments that the Republicans have zero interest in largely for principled reasons, but also now they have a very major fiscal argument to make about this, is that Medicaid rolls are going to grow because people are losing health insurance because they're losing their jobs. And so if their private insurance company is no longer covering them, then they're going to go on to Medicaid. But to include Medicaid expansion and to add a whole new population of folks who would not have qualified anyway, then that's going to cause further drains on state coffers, and the state government has to provide a fairly high percentage of that money. So in this way, Medicaid expansion is going to be used as a campaign issue, but it's not really going to be much of a policy issue, I think, this year.
Health insurance likely to be an issue in the presidential race as
right.
well. We know North Carolina is a battleground. Is this a Trump state, or is this a presumably Joe Biden state?
Again, hard to say. I think it's probably going to be a very close state once again. And the and part of this has to do with the fact that the president the president's base seems to be very, very solidly behind him and remain that way. And you saw that during some of the recent protests at the state capitol. You saw an awful lot of Trump support out there. Vice President Biden is going to get probably lots and lots of endorsements from the African-American community, from some traditional Democratic stronghold groups. And so then it's going to be a battle, as they say, a battle for the suburbs.
Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly.
And turnout's going to be the key, as it always is.
Right. This is going to be a fascinating race for all sorts of reasons. Even before COVID-19, it was shaping up to be fascinating, particularly the presidential and gubernatorial races and the Senate race. Carolina Journal will be following all of these key races. You can log on to carolinajournal.com to check out the very latest election coverage. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.